things in life that you can stop, and there's certain things in life that can't be stopped. Let's go.
You still can't get enough of that music. You can't get enough.
Do you think when the NBA comes back, they'll bring that back? That's just because of how big this is, or no?
Well, maybe.
Maybe. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Final Play podcast. This week, still recapping all the episodes of The Last Dance. The last two episodes, so to say, were episode 3 and 4. So we're recapping both of those episodes.
Are we going to say that these are the best two so far? And then next week we'll say, these two are the best so far.
Yeah, I think so.
It's just exceeding expectations for me.
I think these two are probably the best two so far, probably because of one person, and that's probably because of Dennis Rodman.
And once again, that's probably an extremely biased opinion from where I sit. But anyway,
I think everybody's been saying the same thing. Everybody, it just focused on that the mercurial person that is Dennis Rodman.
And it could have been so much better as well. Like, you know, if they had, if those cameras had have followed that bike away from the United Center, and followed him to the airport and off to Vegas with one Carmen Electra, that would have been one goddamn wild 48 hours, or supposed 48 hours that he went to Vegas for.
I heard another little rumor too that Madonna knew he was in Vegas, and she was, this is all out there, but she was ovulating and wanted Roman to get on a private jet to go to New York because she was ovulating. So
that's
something like this. This is Dennis Rodman pretty much rolled into one. So
yeah, no, pretty much. Well, and the thing is too, like, you know, Carmen Electra has come out and she's done a couple of interviews after. This is probably the most she's been interviewed in the last 15 years or so.
I forgot her. I literally forgot how she looked.
But she'd sort of come out and said that Dennis, you know, that he just wanted those two to be together. He never asked her to be with another woman or, you know, sort of get anything sort of, you know, freaky with other than just those two.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just wanted them two to be, you know, happy and just have, like, bulk sex, I suppose. But,
but look, with Dennis Rodman, okay, off the court, colourful as ever, and that's just how he is, and he's fine, he's happy with that. On the court... Completely different person.
Exactly, and that's what we sort of said about in the last pod that we did, that, you know, he's the ultimate professional when it comes to earning the respect of the teammates. He's always going to be there and do his job. Mm-hmm. You know, whether he's hungover, whether he's just come back from his little hiatus, he was always going to come back. He was the consummate professional, and he was always going to come. He had the respect of everybody on the team. Yeah, he was wild and crazy, and you know, and that you know, to me, I guess it stems back to, from what I've sort of read up about as well, is, you know, he's the quiet kind of guy on those Pistons teams. You know, obviously he does his job. You know, he smashes people as well as everybody else did on that bad boys team. It's too deep. Yeah,
we'll talk about that later.
You see a couple of clips where he just absolutely annihilates Michael Jordan. It's like, holy shit. But yeah, and it all sort of stems from that the time where he falls asleep in his car, but he's got a shotgun. Yeah. In there, like he's not in the best place. Mm-mm. He looked at Chuck Daly like a father figure. He really loved Chuck, and when he was sort of, you know, I guess sort of unceremoniously dumped from the Pistons, that's when he started to go off the rails a little bit.
Yeah, I and but and then I
totally forgot about the trade from him to San Antonio was for Sean Elliott.
Yeah. I just thought it's just – I don't know if he went off the rail. Well, obviously, look, shotgun in the
car.
He
started.
Yeah, okay.
He started.
I just think he is probably like he had that bottled up personality, and that's probably why he just wanted to get, you know, explode that personality out of there. It was like,
well, it's, I mean,
like
it's
you said, like he see Chuck Daly as a father figure,
yeah,
and he could do nothing in San Antonio. So,
he was a total Jekyll and Hyde. Like, you know, he was super quiet. You know, when he won the Defensive Player of the Year for the first time. You know, he, at the press conference afterward, he was crying like he just – that was just the culmination of everything that he ever wanted to be.
Well,
that's what he wanted to be. He wanted to be the best at what he could think he would be the best as, and that was a defender and be the best rebounder the generation had seen. If you look at the all-time numbers, he's nowhere near the top, but – that some of the things that he sort of said in the interview that he had were just – they were unbelievable. Like the way that he started explaining to the coaching staff and everything. When Michael shoots, you know, it's 3.5 rotations when it goes through and it goes through the net. It bounces back to him. When Scotty shoots, it comes out of his hand sideways.
Yeah.
Just little things like that. You're like, holy mackerel. Like – Who you know, what sort of person does that? Like that's just so meticulous. It's crazy.
And excuse me, because he was originally drafted at 25 years old, so he wasn't a spring chicken when he came in. He was 25 in that in the 86 draft. So he's sort of at the start, like being 25 coming into a team, you know, I guess generally he's still young, I suppose, when you look at
it was a mature age college student, but you know, he had those last 2 years. I think I can't remember where he transferred from, but he transferred to the Southeast Oklahoma State Savages, and just he was averaging like 25 points per game there.
Yeah,
so you know, he can score. Like, I get, you know, the NBA is a different beast. Yeah, and he gets on that Pistons team and he's not required to, so it just, you know, he goes to what he thinks he can do the best.
Yeah, so he got dealt to San Antonio, like you said, and he sort of, it was Chuck Daly relationship and everything. You can tell he just didn't even want to be there at all.
No.
Like, he literally didn't want to be there. It was two seasons, before the Bulls bought him.
Two seasons. Greg Popovich was in the front office then. He wasn't the coach.
Yeah.
And he just didn't want a bar of anything that Dennis was doing. And he was with Madonna at the time, and Madonna was in his ear saying, "You just go out there and be who you are and who you want to be. Don't let people tell you who you are and who you want to be. You just go out there and be you." And that was some good advice for his brand, that's for sure.
Well, he ended up, I mean, and that's probably why, like you said, he really didn't have a good relationship. Well, no one had a good relationship with him, as from San Antonio. So he did go to the Bulls on the cheap with that trade. I can't remember who was who.
Will Perdue.
That's right.
Perdue, like it's the steal. It's the steal trade of the 90s.
I suppose, but then looking at it for the perspective of how he was playing at San Antonio, probably. I mean, I suppose his numbers weren't that bad.
No, really, listen, he's rebounding. That's me. He's still doing his job on the court. I just don't think that team wanted anything to do with what he's doing off the court. You know, the antics that he's sort of coming out with, the blonde hair. He started to do a little bit of the coloring, but most of the time it was just the blonde hair. And I just don't think that sort of fit the image of the San Antonio Spurs. Like, that, yeah, they've got that certain image of who they are, Dennis Rodman was a complete total opposite to that.
I think the first meeting with him and Phil Jackson was at Jerry Krause's house, I believe. Phil said it was not the worst meeting. He didn't stand up. He just, you know, Phil basically said, "Stand up, you know, shake my hand. We were having a proper meeting here." And even Rodman said he didn't really want to have anything to do with it because he was probably still in that, I guess, that stage of, like, you know, I don't know. Like, he just was in that loner stage, is probably, if you would want to call it that.
Well, that's right. Yeah, he just wanted to be himself. He just wanted to play ball. He didn't really care who for. And the way that Phil talks about him as well, like, there's the stories out there that that Phil gives people books to read based on what he think that they'll enjoy and their personality. And yeah, he didn't give Dennis any books, but they connected, you know, sort of on a personal level with Phil and Dennis's passion for Native American history.
They
really bonded on that.
And which he implemented it in training and stretches and everything, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, he's not called the Zen master for no reason. He brought those, you know, those Zen, the yoga, you know, stretches and all that sort of stuff, you know, those sorts of things to a training regime. And I guess they're just designed to clear the head, clear the mind, and get people focused, and that's what he wanted, and more so for Dennis to try and to get him to focus on the goal at hand.
Mm. I do remember in that third episode too, when Gary Payton, they interviewed Gary Payton, and Gary, he said Dennis Rodman was the F up person. He just effed up everything. So he was a pest. He's shutting down whoever he wanted. It was always a challenge for the player.
And coming from one of the biggest serial pests in the NBA at the time, and Gary Payton, Gary Payton did it with his mouth, but he also did it with his actions on the court. Dennis Rodman, later in his career, probably wasn't as vocal as what Gary Payton was, but he still knew how to get inside your head and get you off your game.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and then sort of that third episode, I don't know, it sort of finished.
It chopped and changed a little bit. It sort of back and forth. Yeah, then it sort of goes back to, you know, back to Michael and the Bulls hiring of Doug Collins in 1986.
Yeah.
It's a genius coaching philosophy. Like, really, like, put the ball in Michael's hands. That's genius. That's genius.
Which Michael then had an affinity with Doug Collins, obviously, then, because he got the ball. Right. All the
He's
time.
Like, hell yeah, sweet. I love this coach.
Because I think that was it. That 90, then that Doug Collins was on that 98 season where Jordan won pretty much every title that was going on that 1988 season, because he had the ball in his hands the whole time. Was that 98? No, 88.
Yeah. So yeah, that 88 season, the 88-89 season where they looked like they were starting to cook a little bit. They had that five game series with the Cavs. The iconic buzzer beater to win the series over Craig Elo, where he hangs in the air.
Elo. He never had a chance.
No chance. And then they sort of interview Ron Harper about it. And, you know, his sort of philosophy on it, it's just like, yeah, I'll take Mike. And then the Cavs coach comes out straight up and says, oh, we're gonna put Craig Elo on Michael. And Ron Harper, like, his face is just dumbfounded, and he's just like, oh, F this shit. Like, whatever. So it was doomed to start. It was absolutely doomed. Oh, man.
He knew straight away. He said, well, if I'm not going to do it.
He knew it was over. It's like, I'll take Michael. And it's just like, no, we'll put Craig Elo on there. And, we all know that sort of worked up.
And it was, I don't know. I mean, obviously it was a great shot because Michael got away from him pretty quickly. But
Elo got there, but it was just the hang in the air. As he's shooting it, as he comes down, and it didn't even look like missing. Nothing but net.
No, it didn't.
It's unbelievable. It's perfect.
unfortunately, they were still coming up a brutal, up against a brutal Pistons side.
Well, that's right, and that's who I've sort of penciled in as these two episodes villain of this week's podcast are the Detroit Pistons. Man, did they give him some curry, so to speak? Like, holy moly!
It wasn't just him anyway. I remember it was everybody on that 30 for 30.
They knew what they had to do. They knew what they had to do.
Yeah, that 30 for 30 episode with the Detroit Bad Boys, I think it was called, or something along those lines. But yeah, just they were brutal to everybody. They knew. Look, you know, you had your Isaiah Thomas, you had your Bill Laimbeer, but they knew they weren't a great side. Even Joe Dumars. They knew they weren't a great side. So it just became physical. And I mean, physical.
And the thing was, that was the league. And it just got let go.
Whistles were blown.
But there weren't suspensions. There weren't anything like that. And it just, that's to me, Michael, for 2 years. 2 years that 89 and 90 season, they made the Eastern Conference Finals. They ended up making the Eastern Conference Finals those 2 3 years in a row, 89, 90, and 91. But you know that those 89, the 89 and the 90 series, they just pummeled and beat the living crap out of Michael because they had Scottie Pippen was starting to come into his own, but. And then, you know, I guess we can talk about, you know, the famous migraine game in 1990 whether or not they had him on the ropes, but the series is tied 3-3, and Scotty, he's got this mad migraine. He goes out there, he can't focus, and he ends up getting pulled, and there was nothing else they could do about it.
No, and that I just watching it and watching how Scotty was, I really don't think he even should have played. It felt like he was literally going to pass out or something, you know.
If it wasn't a game 7 in the Eastern Conference Finals, there's no way he plays.
Yeah, he was.
If it's an elimination, if it's game 1 of the series, okay, maybe. But it's an elimination game, winner takes all, winner goes to the NBA Finals. Like he's always going to. Most competitors are going to go out there and try and give it a whirl.
Mm.
Just didn't work.
Because that's just him. Like, he is a competitor, but
you could just see that. Yeah, and it's just like, well, if the Pistons pick up on this, then they're just gonna go at him. And they ended up doing that, and they ended up going at Scotty, and it just wasn't gonna happen. Like you could just see that he was to the detriment of the team. So they had no choice but to bench him.
Yeah. Oh, he couldn't. He just couldn't. He couldn't see. He couldn't focus.
He had blurred vision. He said he had blurred vision. It wasn't good for him. And that's just how that season ended up playing out. You know, the disappointment of losing that series again. And yeah. I guess, you know, sort of the graciousness that they sort of come across, you know, that the Bulls come across as being beaten again by the Pistons in the Eastern Conference Finals. You know, Jordan doing on-court interviews after the game saying how disappointed he was. I guess you sort of fast forward to the next year in 1991. Detroit still thinks that they're on top of their game. Again, they meet in the Eastern Conference Finals. And they get swept. The Bulls sweep them. Yeah, you know, Michael supposedly goes into the gym and puts on 15 pounds onto that skinny little frame, and you know he wants to be the one to beat up on the Pistons. He's sick of being beaten down.
Yeah.
And yeah, they sweep them. And yeah, you know, the famous walk off where the game is still going.
7.2 seconds left, and they were like 21 or 22 in front. Yeah. And apparently, going from Isaiah Thomas, Bill Laimbeer said, "All right, we're walking off. We're not shaking their hand." And they proceeded to walk off. But it's not even that they walked off the court. They walked straight past them, like literally
past them on the bench, and you could just see them like just going. Okay, like is that what they're doing? They're really doing this? But rewind a couple of years before when the Pistons were at the top of their game, the Boston Celtics did exactly the same thing to them. So, you know, it's if you, yeah, I guess, but you know, basketball historians would know that story. And Isaiah Thomas had to go up and grab, I think it was Kevin McHale, as he was trying to walk off the court and to try and get them to be a little bit, you know, sportsmanlike. And yeah. you could just see that is so uncomfortable, the conversation that the two of them are having after the Pistons beat the Celtics. And you know, that's all the attention goes to the Pistons on them doing it to the Bulls.
I think I just felt because they had that bad boy persona too, so probably played up to a bit of that, really.
Oh, but yeah.
I mean, just walking past them. That's pretty ballsy.
Yeah, exactly. Already. Not walking away, you know, to opposite ends of the court or anything like that. It's walking past them on the bench, and they're all just looking at them with stunned faces going, all right, cool, we're really doing this.
Fast forward then the next year, and then Jerry Krause took a chance on Rodman. That after that sort of season, they picked up Rodman after that, didn't they, on the 93 season?
No, the Spurs had him in that 93-94 and the 94-95 season when Michael goes to play baseball and essentially the Bulls get carried by Scottie Pippen. Still make the playoffs. Like, obviously they didn't make the noise that they were going to make with MJ. You know, the end of that 94-95 season, Michael comes back. They get beat by the Magic, where Horace Grant funnily finds himself and was pretty proud of himself being with that Orlando Magic team that beat the Bulls in the playoffs in 1995. Horace Grant sort of, yeah, comes into this, you know, into this one a little bit. They sort of interview him, and he had some choice words for those Pistons teams. And
oh,
I don't think he was very impressed. That sort of come out in the fourth episode. Where he sort of called them straight up bitches.
He literally said that too. Straight up bitches.
He was very unimpressed with what was happening.
I just remember then sort of after the meeting then with Phil and Dennis, and they fast forwarded again another 5 years when Scotty decided to return because he. I guess he realizes that he was, you know, having the standoff wasn't going to work because he was going to get fined eventually.
I think he'd sort of calmed down a little bit too. Like, you know, you see it at the end of the second episode. He's pretty upset with Jerry Krause. But I can only assume that there's two people in his ear, and that's Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan. And the best thing for Scotty was to just come back and once again focus on the job at hand. Let's win another championship.
But then, just before the end of the fourth episode, and I think the director Jason Ayers done it really well. But he, Rodman, then obviously because he was playing the really good guy, the second guy on the Bulls, Pippen's come back, and then he's sort of basically come to Phil and said, "I want a vacation."
Well, yeah, Dennis thinks he's the third wheel.
He
I think he liked the fact that Jordan had to rely on him.
By the time
Scotty come back, like Scotty Pippen missed 35 games. They were 24 and 11.
After starting
0-4 that season in 1997-98, they started 0-4 and they were 24 and 11.
Yeah.
When Scotty came back. Dennis just came straight out and just said, "Look, yeah, that's." It's taken a little bit of a mental toll on him. Like I think he, yeah, what like I said, I think he liked the fact that Jordan had to rely on him, and he knew that he was always going to have his back. But I think that that sort of, you know, stressed out and took its toll mentally on Dennis, and he went to he goes to Phil and says, look, I need a vacation.
But the funny thing is, then they've sort of cut to Jordan's reaction, which they the directors had it on the phone showing Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman and Phil Jackson. Scotty's loving it. He's laughing already. Because basically,
Jordan's reaction is priceless.
Jordan's reaction, because he said, didn't he say, you know, dude, you let this guy to go to vacation, we're not going to see him again.
But yeah, that's right. There's no bleeping way that we're going to see him again. Like, he's not going to come back.
If anybody needs a vacation, I need a vacation.
Yeah, so yeah, I need one. Not Dennis. I need one.
Apparently they decided to he wanted to go to Vegas, and they end up coming up with the idea of just 48 hours.
48 hours.
And that's sort of how it finished.
And then episode 3 shows him riding off into the night from the United Center to embark on his on his debaucherous trip to Las Vegas with Carmen Electra.
Because then episode 4 then picks up right up where episode 3 led off, where it had, I guess, Rodman stretching
the hours counting up
beyond the allocated 48 hours. Well, I was just going back to look at it before, and I think it says 88 hours over, but who knows? Basically, he could have had weeks over. Who knows? They didn't show a lot of the Vegas stuff. Like, there was a little bits, which is pretty cool, like in the strip clubs.
That's so disappointing.
I wanted every
bit of that 48 hours documented.
That's because Carmen Electra was in it. That's the only reason.
Well, yeah, true. Yeah, there could have been.
And just to see what you actually
know. I'm sure there would have been a lot of, you know, clothed outings in Vegas, and there would have been a lot of unclothed innings, shall we say, that would have happened while they were in Vegas. But Carmen Electra was interviewed for this and basically said it was an occupational hazard being Dennis Rodman's girlfriend.
<That's right. laughs> She was in all this. She was there the whole time. Well, they were together. So.
No, right. Yeah, exactly.
It was just a party, just him just smashing those kamikaze shots as gold and buddy.
Oh, he's just cruising around, just drinking beers everywhere. You're like, yeah, all right. He's taken full advantage of it.
So then it cuts to where apparently MJ, he was taking too long, Dennis, and then MJ had to go and get him out of bed, which we end up finding out that the show said the doco said he flew to Vegas and got him out of bed.
I guess it sort of implies that he went to Vegas to go and rescue Dennis, but yeah, it sort of comes out later that, he's not actually he's back home.
Yeah, he's back home.
He's back home in Chicago, and supposedly his apartment was right across the road from the United Center, which is fantastic. Like, you know, you wake up 10 minutes before training. Sweet, all I've got to do is just duck across the road. But Michael comes and knocks on his door, his apartment was fridge, couch, mattress on the floor, bedroom, and yeah, apparently him and Carmen are just lying there, you know, as you do, just like nude, and yeah, Michael's at the door, so she jumps behind the couch to hide, and Michael comes in to say, look, hurry the hell up, like we've got training, like let's go.
Then cut to then after that. So they, you know, Dennis is back training, and Phil does this Native American, or he called it the Indian runs, basically.
He runs in a line
around the gym. Whenever the whistle's blowing, the guy at the back of the line, I remember writing all this down, the guy at the back of the line has to sprint to the front.
They have to catch the person who's at the front of the line.
Jordan being like, you know, I guess the leader and all that, had the whole team on the same page that they would jog to make the drill as easy as possible.
Yeah.
But Then when it was Rodman's turn to run to the front, he took off in a dead sprint. So do you want to say
that's the thing? It took them four laps of the court to catch him.
Yep. So
when you hear that and you're just like, man.
It's just Dennis Rodman, but it's also just Dennis doing what Dennis wants to do. He don't listen to nobody.
Exactly.
Well,
and that's the thing that I've heard a couple of times. Sort of listening to different shows and radio shows and podcasts and stuff. Dennis. He's that wild kid at school. He didn't need a father figure. He just needed an authority figure. Mike was that authority figure, and he's gonna go out and be crazy all day, but you know he's gonna be home for dinner, and that's sort of the analogy that they put it as, he's that wild kid, he's gonna roam the streets and run around and throw rocks at cars and do all sorts of stupid crap like that, but you know he's gonna be home for dinner, and I think that's the perfect analogy.
Dennis Rodman. Yeah, that is Dennis Rodman all in one. Oh. So the story, I guess it then shifted to Phil Jackson's upbringing, which I didn't know a lot about.
Unless you sort of read his books or sort of delve into it, I don't think a lot of people know Phil's. No, that's right.
The only thing you sort of
think of would be the two championships he won with the Knicks, like after when he was there in 72 and 73.
Yeah.
And you don't really sort of know a lot about his playing career or a lot. Man, he was a wiry, weird-looking dude as a player. Like, he had sort of wide shoulders, but he was still a wiry-looking bloke. Like, it was...
He's still... Yeah. Even now, you see him. He's got wide shoulders. He's ridiculously... Yeah. Those shoulders are massive, so... Yeah.
He's a big dude. Like, 6'7".
Yeah. He had that even when he... But you could see when he was playing at the Knicks, it felt like it was a little bit of, like, Rodman-esque, like, rebounding the way he was, like,
grabbing the ball. That's right, exactly. He was a terrific rebounder on that squad.
They showed a little bit of that upbringing where he was in Montana, and you could sort of see straight away he had that Native American culture already accustomed to him.
That's right.
Then he sort of shifted... there's a whole thing of him. He was a hippie. Everything that I took out of that, he was a hippie and did acid. That's what I took out of that a lot. So,
but the first interview that he had, Jerry Krause had identified him when he was coaching in the CBA before, and apparently beforehand he'd even coached in Puerto Rico, and he reckons some of those games were just insane that he coached over there. But yeah, he'd been on the Jerry Krause radar for a little while, coaching in CBA.
That Puerto Rico league, I wrote a little bit of that down. It was insanely competitive. They said they smeared obviously towns didn't like towns, and they smeared chicken blood on the opposing team's benches.
Yeah, it's like
A mayor actually shot an official in the leg and was punished by not only being not allowed to the – you can only – just basically – the punishment was that he just was barred for the rest of the season. That was it.
Yeah, that was it. Was it just road games or was it the whole season, like, home and road games? I thought it was just road games.
No, it's just the home game. So he could go to the road games. He was not allowed to be at the team's home games for the rest of – only boy, one season. God. So, but like you said, then he worked his way into the CBA and won a championship with the worst name that I remember, the Patroons. The Patroons! Oh, my God. And you said, Jerry Krause had sort of seen him in the CBA, and he Krause called him up to be his assistant to Doug Collins. Cut to, I guess, probably the biggest thing I loved out of that episode, because it's won my team a lot of championships, and then it was the where Doug Collins refused, but they wanted to implement the infamous, or no, I wouldn't say the infamous, the famous triangle offense.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Well, as they sort of go through the episode, like the guy that Phil is basically Phil's mentor is Tex Winter, and that's where Phil gets the basic philosophy of the triangle offense, And like I said, yeah, he's the one that tries to implement that with Doug Collins. But Doug's like, no, our cash cow is Michael Jordan. Yeah, the triangle offense promotes ball movement and taking the ball out of Michael's hands. And it's just like, well, this could be a problem. This is why we're not getting as far as what we could, because we need to involve more people.
Yeah. It just shows you that, to me, not only obviously that how, well, you have to be ridiculously fit, and how if you don't know what you're doing, it's very complicated, the triangle offense.
No, that's
but
right, yeah. It's simple in philosophy, but if you're not with it, and even then, like I think Scottie Pippen might have said it, or actually no, it might have been Steve Kerr, as they come together for that second three-peat, and it was a few different players on there, and it took them nearly a year to get to get it down packed.
The whole thing of basketball is, it's a team game, and then that was why they couldn't win. That's to me, that triangle offense, you know, they talk about Phil Jackson, but to me, that triangle offense is the reason why Scottie Pippen was so good, because he could get the ball.
He was the very first sort of point forward, take the ball away from your traditional point guard, you know, your John Stocktons, your Isaiah Thomases, those sorts of players. Even to a lesser extent, Ron Harper, who was at the Cavs then. But, you know, your quintessential point guards, they're the ones that run the team, and they're your playmakers. That's who everything is filtered through. But they gave that responsibility to Scottie Pippen.
He embraced it. Obviously they embraced it up until, unfortunately, they lost that game seven against the Detroit Pistons, but that was the Pippen's migraine probably didn't really help to that. It just, for Jordan, it just kept eating at him and eating at him that he wasn't in the same conversation as Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, and that's purely because of the one
thing that he wanted. That's what he wanted when he come into the league. He wants to be in that conversation with Magic and Larry. That's who he wants to be, the absolute best in the game. And when he come into the league, they were the two guys that were the best in the league.
Yeah. And they were. Yeah. So, like you touched on Horace Grant, that was just, I mean, obviously they're straight up bitches, but.
He was in that first three-peat, or, you know, how they go up to it in these two episodes. They only go up to Michael winning his first championship in 1991. He's an integral part of that.
Yeah. Because MJ put him in line. MJ basically said, stop whining to the refs, you know.
No, that's right. Because he kept taking shots. As soon as you show that, then they know that they've got you.
The Pistons had him.
They know that they've got you.
Yep.
Because all you're doing is whining and complaining to the referee. They're hitting me hard. That's not who they want. They've just had that for the last 2 years. It's like that attitude now is gone. We are going to be the one to be the hitting. We are going to be the one to dominate this team. And that's eventually ended up what happening.
And they did, obviously, like you mentioned earlier, that they swept the Detroit Pistons.
And I think that also had a lot to do. You know, obviously, like we said, you know, they were up 21 when Adrian Dantley was at the free throw line with 7 seconds to go. I think that was the thing. It was the humiliation that the Pistons suffered, because, like we said, they still thought they were on top, and they've just been swept. And then in game four, they just had their asses handed to them by 20 plus points.
Yeah.
And I think I think a lot of that, you know, one of the reasons why that they did what they did was the absolute humiliation.
Whoa, sorry. it was. And sorry, I'm watching Jerry Krause dancing on the private plane. That ridiculous dance that he does. That was terrible. Those hips were, I don't know, those hips were out of control. Anyway, that's coming up. Because they end up, obviously, I didn't want to touch on this because I just want to get your thoughts. So they had the walk-off. They didn't shake anybody's hands. And Isaiah Thomas, as great as Isaiah Thomas was, thinks that was a little bit of the catalyst of him not making that beautiful, beautiful 1992 Dream Team that no one was going to beat ever. You could put any, you know, that just was the Dream Team.
You could have the Dream Team versus the World Team and they still wouldn't have won.
They wouldn't have come within 20 points. But Isaiah thinks that that walk-off contributed at least to him not making a Dream Team. We were just talking about it earlier. I don't think there was a place for him. And if there was, who do you take out?
Well, that's right. As we sort of went through the Dream Team there, he's obviously the point guard there. Magic Johnson is going to take that role as your starter. But they also, Jordan was there. And the other two guards were Clyde Drexler and John Stockton.
Yeah.
So who do you turf? The only one that I could honestly see is Clyde Drexler. That's the only one I could think that they could turf out of that 92 Dream Team. But you can't turf anyone out of that team. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that means out of the four guards that they've got on that team, three of them are point guards. If you put Isaiah Thomas in there and take Clyde Drexler out, the only person who is your traditional shooting guard then is Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Everybody else is a point guard. John Stockton, Isaiah Thomas, and Magic Johnson. So it upsets the balance of the team.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, you could name a second Dream Team anyway, and they still would have won the Olympics.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
You could have almost named like a college team. they still would have whomped everybody, because if you just go a college team, the first three names that pop off the top of my head out of that 92 draft is Alonzo Mourning, Shaquille O'Neal, and Christian Laettner. And obviously Christian Laettner makes the Dream Team, know, as that amateur that come into the team. No question about it that he was probably the best player in college then, even though he didn't go number one. The consensus number one was Shaquille O'Neal. But could you imagine those three beating up on the world's teams in the Olympics? Like, good God.
Especially Shaq. Jesus Christ.
Oh, man.
So they come up against the Lakers in the NBA Finals. They lose the first game. They lost the first game. I wouldn't say it was decisive or anything, but they, in Jordan's words, they lost the first game, but they were super confident because they reckon that was one of the worst games they ever played, and they only lost by, 10 or 12. They end up obviously then coming back and then, you know, winning the next four games and then smashing the Lakers. But John Paxson, that's what I took out of that sort of final series. Just the open shots he was hitting because obviously everyone was trying to double team Jordan, kickouts that he was getting, and
he's just wide, sweet he's wide open. Was that him. I think it was game three. That really kicked things wide open, and they sort of gone right. We're gonna double Michael. We're obviously gonna take the ball out of his hands. And Paxton just found himself as the beneficiary.
That's a sweet shot too. Beautiful shot.
It's a nice stroke. It's a nice stroke.
I did love, obviously, after that, and this is not a knock against the Detroit Pistons, but how Magic embraced, obviously, Jordan after the game. Even they all went to the locker room, I think, if I read it correctly. They all, the Lakers, I don't know if it was all of them, but basically.
Magic came out. That's easy, essentially. And for me, that's sort of the passing of the torch.
And Magic said all the time, he said, especially their Dream Team, he said, you know, he played against them in the finals and they went to the Dream Team. He said that first training session, he knew within 10 minutes that Michael Jordan was the best ever. He's always said it from that first training session in the Dream Team. He said it's just unbelievable what he could do. He's just, you know, he's on a different level. And this is Magic Johnson saying that. Was there any sort of thing I missed? Was there anything that sort of that finished on that episode four? Because obviously it was that culmination, you know, another great sort of Jordan holding, you know, all the emotions pouring out and holding the Larry O'Brien trophy. Like that whole, yeah, that was the other sort of thing towards the end there. He's poor of emotion, so to speak.
No, that's right. And that's what a lot of people had said. They hadn't really seen that type of emotion out of Michael. All they'd seen is a lot of, angry Michael. The outpouring of the emotion of winning his first championship. And, you know, like we said earlier, putting himself on that pedestal of he thinks now that he is in the conversation now with Magic and with Larry.
Yeah. Exactly. He had to win a title to be in that conversation.
Oh, no, of course.
It ended sort of, the episode to me ended really weird. It just sort of ended where they all got on a private plane after the Broncos beat the Packers in the Super Bowl. And obviously, I think everybody had the Packers because it was an NFC team. And then the Broncos end up winning. And then who is he?
He is just roasting Scott Burrell.
Burrell.
Absolutely roasting him. And he said, don't put that on camera. Don't film that. Don't put that on camera. He's basically telling, hey mom, yeah, your kid's an alcoholic. Like, you know, your kid, he's going out all night and staying out all night and bringing, you know, unruly women back to his hotel room. Don't put that on camera. It's just like, oh man, he is just torching him.
And then obviously we it finished, and then sort of, I guess, how the prelude to the Jazz and Bulls. And Jazz, it was a finals preview, basically, and the Jazz fighting back and the Bulls and beating them. That was such a good game, actually.
It was just, yeah, I think that game was just before the All-Star break. So, yeah, like you said, yeah, that's how they – that's yeah, the doco sort of, yeah, does a little bit of sort of jumping around a little bit, which is, yeah, it's kind of strange how they're doing it. Not that it's bad or anything, but you know, when you're talking about it, yeah, you sort of you get out of a rhythm, when you have to jump from 1991 to back to 1997, and even then, you know, once again, it's Jerry Krause coming out and making some pretty ordinary statements about, you know, the team and Jordan's future, right before that game and right before the All-Star break, like you just couldn't have picked a worse time to be coming out and saying all this sort of stuff. And I guess that's how the episode ends. And you're like, oh, that's, I mean, it just leaves you frothing for more.
Oh, just like, excuse me, Jerry Krause again, just, we'll go back on Jerry Krause. He's an absolute villain.
Yeah, he's a second tier villain in this one. Like, you know.
A couple of things we missed. We didn't end up talking about the so-called Jordan rules that the Pistons had.
No, well, it's I think they're sort of, well, and once again, you know, if you're a bit of a basketball historian, then you would know about these rules. But yeah, you know, we've actually got them sort of, you know, written down as a, you know, as a to sort of let everybody know what they actually were and what the Pistons, you know, come up with their sort of philosophy on how to beat Michael.
Well, this is as described by former Pistons coach Brendan Malone. Number one, on the wings, push him to the elbow. Don't let him drive baseline, which, yeah, you just don't want him for, well,
that's
Michael. Number two, when he's on top, influence him to the left, which that's kind of, in a way, because he's right-handed. That's not a bad idea.
No, that's not a bad idea, but that's just a general coaching principle to start with. If you're right-handed, then you try you try everything you can to try and force somebody to go left.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. With your left, yeah, exactly right. That is coaching coaching philosophy 101.
Yeah.
Number three, when he got the ball in the low post, trap him from the top.
Sure. So, and then you're using the baseline as another defender. Yeah, especially if he gets on that low block, then yeah, it's right. It's sort of contradicting the first rule. You don't want to push him baseline, but at least you're getting the double team there.
I think all these rules are playing into them, this last one. So like, you know, you can't do that before. If he gets in the paint, knock him down to the ground. So that's rule four.
That really should be rule one.
That should be rule one. And there shouldn't be any more rules after that.
No, that's right, exactly. Oh, if he gets in the paint, smash him. And boy, did they do a lot of that. Because, you know, obviously Michael lived in the paint. He had that terrific mid-range game as well. But, you know, that was his thing as well, is to get into the paint. And he was getting, you know, two fouls every time. Yeah, you know, every time he got hit, just depend on who the referees wanted to blow the whistle on.
Yeah, and they could see, obviously he's getting frustrated too, which again plays into the Pistons, because you frustrate the best player, he can't shoot properly. That's the way it is. So, anything else we sort of missed before we wrap this up?
Just sort of doing a little bit of poking around on some post show. Some post-episode shows. Jalen and Jacoby had Jason Eyre on after episodes 2 and 3, pretty much straight after it. They sort of go on about what it was like when he actually interviewed Dennis Rodman in L.A. And he basically come out and said that interviewing Dennis was like interviewing a feral cat, which I guess... Yeah, it's not really disrespectful or anything like that, but, yeah, apparently he's just looking around the room all the time. Like, he's just, it was just hard to sort of try and tie him down a little bit. But once he did tie him down, he was really good. So the story goes that he drove up from Orange County. They'd set up the interview. They had, like, a five-hour window that they wanted to do the interview in. He shows up 2 hours late, has no idea who this guy is. They get into the elevator, and Dennis is, so what's this for again? So he's got no idea why he's there. So he tells him that the outline of what the interview and everything's for. And he's just like, you know, we've got a 5 hour window and, you know, that's cut it down a little bit now that you're a little bit late. And, Dennis just says, okay, I'll give you 10 minutes. So they're like, all right, that's a little awkward. They get into the room as they're about to start the interview. That's supposedly only going to be 10 minutes. As they're miking everybody up, Dennis comes out and says, I need a turkey sub, not a turkey sub, a tuna sub from Subway, and some chamomile tea. And once they got those requests for Dennis, he proceeded to sit down for 3 hours and do the interview, which was awfully nice of him, I thought.
It just plays into the mercurial person that is Dennis Rodman. So
all these years on, and he's and the other thing too, apparently throughout the interview as well, I think that's why it took 3 hours, is he kept wanting to go on about North Korea and Kim Jong-un.
Of course he does.
And they're just like, no, Dennis, we're talking about your 97-98 season. Yeah, that we're not here to talk about North Korea. Like, can we sort of circle back and focus on back then? Okay, all right. So, I guess that would have been a rather difficult interview, but the payoff was awesome.
Yeah, the payoff was awesome. So,
it just left me wanting more. Like, I wanted so much more.
Well, I've left it. I didn't end up looking to see. I'm assuming episode 5 will start tying into a little bit of the Bulls Jazz rivalry, but I didn't end up looking to see what's going to happen in 5 and 6.
I think 5 and 6 sort of go onto them a little bit of their first three-peat. It sort of goes into I guess what everybody sort of knows about as well, and Michael Jordan and his gambling habit. I won't say problem. His gambling habit, which apparently had just an insatiable appetite for the gamble.
I don't think it was world known. Like, if you're a casual fan, I really don't think you would know much about that.
And then no. But if you're a bit of a basketball fan and especially through that time period, then it was pretty well known that he loved a punt.
He loved the punt. Yeah, he really did.
If it was at McDonald's, he'd probably bet on two ants running across the table, or you know, two pick, if he threw two pickles at that the window, which pickle was going to make the bottom first? Like, I reckon he'd bet on that.
That's kind of interesting because obviously this whole thing is really centered around how great he was and everything, but it's interesting that they're touching on something that isn't too good about him, so to speak.
No, that's right. Past is sort of coming back a lot. And like we said in the first two episodes, he hasn't chopped out any of this. Like anything that they asked him about and they interviewed him about, he answered.
Yeah. Yeah. True. Yeah. Okay.
And I guess it's an integral part of the story, really.
Well, it is. It is. It's just. It is, and it's funny how, I mean, that this is why I think, you know, they, like you said, the whole chop and change, they only really filmed that 1 year, really, at the end of the day. So to me, they had to go back years, like chop and change all the time. As kind of all over the shop it is, you know, it's still centered around that last season, really, no, anyway.
But they had to
chop and change it.
It's part of the story as well. Like, you can't just tell the story of that 97-98 season and not have anything previously to sort of base what it's on.
If there's any Australian fans out there, I did find out apparently, so Luke Longley, who's the massive Australian centre, if you're a casual fan, that played in that last season, played a few seasons with the Bulls anyway, but apparently he was keen to do it. Even the director was Jason Eyre was keen to get him, but apparently there was a budgetary issue, which...
budget issue. Give me a break.
Which I don't. I mean, yeah, okay, he might have been in Australia and then, you know, all these people in America. But, you know, like Miles sort of said it at the start of the, well, before we got on the pod, you know, this is going to make hundreds of millions of dollars anyway. It wouldn't have cost him that much. Probably like a couple of grand for the flights.
Even if it cost him $5,000, fly him over.
The whole thing cost him $50,000, or, you know, air flights and everything. Like, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that's not much, really.
That's chump change.
But, yeah.
Michael's got to pay for it. He's got plenty of money.
But then even that, you don't even have to have him there. Why, you know, even just having an interview over a Skype or something like that, you know, that would have been interesting to hear his take on it.
Oh, that's right. How much have they interviewed Bill Wennington so far?
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Interesting to see. I can't wait for episodes 5 and 6 now. I want to see how much Bill Wennington's got to say about that.
I'm good. I think we're going to finish on that because that's hilarious to finish on Bill Wennington.
I want more Wennington. Give me more Wennington.
Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter's at The Final Play Pod. You can find the podcast pretty much everywhere now. Spotify, Gimco, SoundCloud, I think still, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, SoundCloud was still there. Podbean.
Yeah, and slowly but surely trying to get Apple, but that's a longer process. So hopefully we can get that one soon.
So much easier on Spotify.
It is. But, you know, there's a lot of people that love Apple, so we've got to get on all of them.
No, it's true. We've got to collect them all.
That'll do it for me. My name's Jason Wennington Smith.
there's going to be a Wennington in there.
Every day Smith.
No, Dan, that's true. Yeah. Interview Wennington Smith. just for this week, it's been Linsanity week. So my name is Miles Lynn Plum. I'll go back to my Asian heritage a little bit, but
Lynn Plum.
It does, yeah. It just rolls off the tongue. It's fantastic.
Sounds like an Asian cuisine. That's so racist.
Yeah,
anyway.
It's got a little bit of black bean sauce in it.
My God. You're touching it worse than I did. Have a good week, everyone.
All right, see ya.